This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, and welcome to It's a Fandom Thing. I'm your host, Erin Marlowe, and each week I'm joined by a panel of guests to discuss all things fandom and pop culture, primarily from a female perspective. You'll find everything from fanfic to cosplay to Schitt's Creek to Supernatural and everything in between. So put on your favorite piece of fandom merch, set aside that fanfic that you're writing about your OTP, and sit back and enjoy this week's episode. Hello, and welcome to this special episode of It's a Fandom Thing. On this interview episode, I am very, very excited to be sitting down with Richard Gurman, who has written this book that if you're a fan of Married with Children, like, you need to read this book, I think. It'll give you a greater appreciation of the show, the industry, everything that went into making this show the success that it was. And that book is called Married with Children Versus the World, which is the perfect title for a book about married with children, I think. And it's the inside story of the shock com that launched Fox and changed TV comedy forever. Richard worked in Hollywood for over 35 years, writing, producing, and show running such popular TV shows as Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Mork and Mindy, Different Strokes, Facts of Life, Married with Children, and Still Standing. In 2017, he produced the documentary film This is Bob Hope for the PBS series American Masters. And in 2020, along with director John Sheinfeld, he executive produced the documentary The Happy Days of Gary Marshall for ABC. So welcome, Richard. I'm so, so excited to have you on. So thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
And I wanted to just first start out with, so what was it about this time period, or why did you want to write this book about the show?
Well, I owe a lot to the show, and I wanted to provide a legacy. You know, I mean, it's its own legacy. It's still on the air. People love it. You know, it's spawned other shows. But I wanted to let people know kind of everything that went into it. It wasn't just this coincidence. It was very well planned. It very much came out of its time. And, you know, I thought it was fascinating. And I was hoping that fans would find it as fun too. I didn't want it to be academic, you know, or, you know, bookish. I wanted to keep it on a funny level. And I thought I could balance those things. And one of the other thing is that the fans have complained, and particularly online, that there was no closure to the show, that there wasn't a final episode. And I was hoping in a way to give some closure in this book to people who were kind of looking for that. So that was part of my drive. I had the most amazing time in life doing this. So, you know, I wanted to share it and tell why and just honor the people that were just so good to me and so good to everyone else, and kind of give it to the people who weren't.
Yeah. And it definitely doesn't come off as academic or anything like that. It's very, you know, my podcast, we cover fandom and pop culture and everything. And so, as a fan of the show personally, and we did an episode talking about Married with Children a couple of years ago, actually. And so as a fan, it was like even more inside stuff that I was like, oh, I wish I'd even had this book before we recorded that episode. And it does give you that, you can tell how much you really love the show and appreciate the show and appreciate the people. And so I wanted to talk about that a little bit, about especially about the showrunners who were there, that they weren't there for the whole run, but who created the show, the co-creators, Michael Moore and Ron Levitt. And I want to talk about them because you talk so lovingly about this environment that they created that was so open and warm and welcome. So how did that help you as a creator and as someone who ended up becoming a co-showrunner in season 10? How did that help you?
Well, they just created this atmosphere where it's interesting. It's a playground. I mean, you have to make fun things happen. You have to be funny. You have to be expressive. You have to be wild. You have to be unlimited. But you also, it's like $1 million a week product that you have to make along an assembly line, and you have to deliver it in the network. So they had this unique ability to get to work and get work done and also sort of have fun along the way. And there are a lot of people that I work for who have sort of one or the other of those qualities. And they managed to, you know, you would just sit down and you'd come to work and yeah, you could tell stories and you could tell anecdotes, but they just embraced ideas from everyone. They were kind to everyone. They didn't care. Yeah, there was a pecking order. They were executive producers and they were supervising producers and they were story editors and they were staff writers and so on and so forth. But one of the things they taught me, and one of the things that was infectious with the whole staff and the crew and everything, is that an idea can come from anyone. If an idea can make the show better or funnier, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to, you know, come from the top. It can come from anyone. It's very collaborative. So they were very generous in allowing ideas to come from everyone, which taught me a lot. And they just, I don't know, they just weren't snobby. I mean, you see their humor, so you know that they're not snobby. And they just had this tremendous work ethic, and they would help people in. There's a writer who was wanted a freelance assignment who was going to lose his house and didn't have a house payment. They brought him in and gave him a freelance assignment. There were people who wanted promotions, you know, because they needed money for their kids or whatever. He would help them get promotion. They would help them get promotions. And in return, you know, everyone would do whatever they could for them. So, you know, I guess, you know, a long way of saying that I learned that being generous kind of pays off, not in a calculated way. And I guess one of the things one of the first questions you asked is why I'm doing this is to sort of be generous in return and shine a spotlight on them and what they did and how they did it.
Yeah, because you share like a story in there of the production assistant who wanted to get like promoted. And once they were re-signing their contract, like they made it as they stipulated in there that this person, yeah. I mean, that's pretty incredible in a business that can sometimes be very cold and not feeling. You know, yeah. So yeah, that really impressed me.
Oh yeah, they would absolutely go out of that. There was one story that I didn't include in the book, and there were just too many stories to include. Where in the middle of the night, Ron Levitt, executive producer, gets a call from David Faustino that David Faustino is in some kind of peril, in some kind of drug bust, in some park, someplace, and could he come and bail him out? And Ron goes and he tries to find him. And he's not there. And then Ron gets another phone call, cell phone, they somewhere else. And so, well, it turned out to be an imposter, somebody who was imitating David's voice. And here Ron was in the middle of the night going out, risking, you know, his life for his cast member, you know, based on a random phone call. And that's the kind of guy that Ron and Michael both were. So there you go.
Wow. That's very special. That's very special. And I'm sure as a creator yourself and as a writer, did that help you then feel like even more empowered to be even more creative in your approaches to things you were working on?
Yeah, and take risks, because if you went out on a limb, they were going to go out on a limb for you. And they did. They promoted me, and I ended up running the show, you know, at a certain point. And okay, I'll tell you another story. And this wasn't in the book. Our offices are right off the main writing room, and the main writing room is where we all assemble and write. And so I was going off to my office, and I saw somebody walking out of my office suspiciously and walking down the hall. And I looked and I saw that he had stolen my wallet out of my desk. And so I went back into the main room and I said, crap, someone stole my wallet and I got to get a new license and credit cards. And Ron and Michael got up and they started chasing the guy down the hallway. They were going to beat I wasn't going to beat the crap out of them, but they were going to beat the crap out of them for me. I mean, that's the guys they were. The guy, fortunately for him, got out the door before Ron and Michael could do it. But, you know, that's who they were. And I want to, wherever I can, give back. That's one of my motivations. So
that really just permeated every single chapter, pretty much. Even when they were no longer there, you still could feel that presence and everything. And then, of course, I want to talk about the cast, because the cast is incredible. And you talk a lot about the struggle, how, especially with Ed O'Neill, how, you know, and I already knew the story of how he walked in and did the sigh, and that's how he got the part of Al Bundy. But they really had to fight for him. And I mean, I can't imagine anyone else playing that role. But watching people fight for him and watching just the cast come together and the cast work and the cast just gel together eventually when you had the core group, and even when you had people leaving and coming in and new characters like Jefferson and stuff. Did that shape or inform you as a writer? Did you learn something from the cast as well and from just their work ethic and how they brought stuff to the characters too?
Yeah, they always brought discipline to the show. They also brought character traits to the show. I mean, Kaija Segal was written as this kind of slovenly wife and sitting on the couch eating bonbons, and you know, a lot of the elements that she didn't like to cook, she didn't like to, you know, do housework and so on and so forth, were there. But she had this sense of this character that was more egotist, that was happier with herself, and that she was proud of herself. And she would get dressed up and she would walk in this, you know, particular style. And the atmosphere that Ron, going back to Ron and Michael, they embraced that. They, you know, they let that happen. You know, Christina and David, you know, they didn't have a lot to do at the beginning, and yet they didn't complain, and they did. They threw themselves into their work, and we used them. They started scoring, and we used them more and more. Ed famously, we were in a rehearsal hall next to Tony Danza on the set, and Tony came out and started picking on Amanda Burse, and Ed came out and like challenged him and sent Tony Danza fleeing. So everyone had each other's back, and you know, that's not to say there was also dissension, and things ended up sort of falling apart a little bit at the end. But there was a great spirit, and also in that spirit, they worked out the comedy on the stage. They, you know, they were generous. They, you know, they allowed each other bits. They didn't try to one up each other. And working with the director, you know, they found things that we didn't even write, that once we saw, we would add to it. So, you know, that was another strong thing about the cast.
Yeah. And I loved that story about Ed and Tony Danza. And then especially because that was when Ed and Amanda were kind of, you know, it's widely known, you talk a lot about it in here, how they weren't getting along.
Yeah.
But Ed still stuck up for her.
Don't screw with my family. You know, I screw with my family, but you can't.
Exactly. Yeah. And then speaking of that, with the cast, there weren't really like the main core cast wasn't like comprised of like stand-up comedians or comedians, even though originally, you know, they wanted, you know, Roseanne Barr and Sam Kinison and everything. And I know you talk about in the book how actually that was pretty deliberate that they didn't want to work with stand-up comedians. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, it's funny because there was a bit of a miscommunication, a huge miscommunication about that. When Ron and Michael devised the series, there's something that in the trade you call an elevator pitch. You say, you boil your pitch down to three or four words so people can understand it. And the elevator pitch for this show was, what if Roseanne Barr and Sam McKinnison got married and had kids? You know, that's what the show would be. That said, they had no intention of hiring Roseanne Barr and Sam McKinnison. But the studio executives went out and made offers to Roseanne and Sam. And the network was kind of tempted by it because here was this new network and here were these big names. They weren't as big as they were later, but still. So Sam and Roseanne had no intention of doing it, and they turned it down. And so then you start in your casting process, and whoever you cast now has to measure up to what the network thought they may have had in Sam and Roseanne. And they went for, I mean, Ed O'Neill had just this drama background. He'd done one pilot, I think Popeye Doyle or something like that for the network, but he was mainly a serious dramatic actor. And his agent, he was in town, and we had gone through a huge number of people. Michael Richards was considered for the part. He didn't come up to what people's expectations were. It was a very, very hard part to cast. And we weren't looking for comics. And Ed O'Neill just came in one day and just impressed the hell out of Ron and Michael. And Michael tells this story about how Ed opened the door and he gave out this sigh. And Michael said he didn't have to say another word because he was the only character who played it where as soon as he walked in the door, he knew his life was going to be just as bad as the life he left behind it at work. And he sort of had him at get-go. Katie Sagal had been up. She had a small part in a Mary Tyler Moore series before that. But she was a singer. She was a rocker. She was a backup singer for Bette Midler. David Garrison was a professional actor. He had been in a series that Ron and Michael had before. And Amanda Burst had been in Fright Night. And the two kids were relatively inexperienced. You know, they'd had some parts before. So, no, we didn't go after stand-ups. And, you know, just I think the grittiness of the characters and the whole idea didn't suggest stand-ups. It suggested, you know, actors. Yeah.
And you know, I always say on this podcast, comedy is so hard to do and to get it right. And you have to have incredibly talented actors to be able to realize that. And I think this cast definitely did. And I don't think they get enough credit, honestly, for the work.
They were absolutely amazing. Yeah. It's funny about Christina, where she had this thing of playing such a ditzy character and, you know, malaprops and yet she played it. She grounded it in such a smartness. She played it as if she were the smartest person in the room, which made you think twice about it. And then also it made you actually think about what she said, because sometimes those things were smarter than what you thought. And she just brought just wonderful elements to that. David had found this life as a rapper sort of outside the show. And he brought that to his character, and he boosted his character towards the, you know, when characters are starting to, you know, reach their peak or something, he boosted up his character during that time. I mean, Ed just had his down. I mean, Ed just channeled his character, and Katie brought this. One of the things that we're looking for in Katie, and particularly in the kids, is that there's such an edginess about the authority, you know, about Al. There's such a, you know, you could say mean-spirited, but there's love underneath it. And you want to make sure, even in that era before today's quality, you know, messages more, you didn't want to feel sorry for the wife. The humor would just go away if she were just mousy and so on. And Katie just brought this strength. And I wrote in the book, sometimes she felt sorry for Al, you know, I mean, because she could just stand up for herself. And if she didn't want to cook and there was no food on the table, too bad. You know, that's what she did for the day. And, you know, she did plenty of other things and she never had to apologize for herself. And it's a testament to her as an actress and as a person that she brought that. And, you know, some of it's written. And some of it is you just find that with the actors bring to it, and then you make the acting and the writing all come together, and it did, and that's what happened.
Yeah, and I want to talk that a little bit more about that with the women in the and the show has been accused by people, I think mainly people who didn't watch the show, but has been accused of misogyny and lots of other things like that. And my podcast, we cover stuff from the female perspective. And I think what's interesting about this show, though, is even though people accuse it of that, you've got, like you said, you have Peggy, who is just as strong as Al, if not sometimes stronger than him in some situations. And then you've also got lots of women who are owning their sexuality and owning that fact, which was really rare back then on television and still kind of rare.
Right.
So I'm wondering, did you ever think of any of it as misogyny, or did you see, or did you think that some of the criticism maybe was coming from the fact that people weren't used to or were afraid of seeing women be that strong?
I think that's true. And I think that particularly, I mean, look at Katie, how strong she was, and Christina and Amanda. I mean, she was incredibly strong, and they were just portrayed as such. And you know, every once in a while, we do an episode where, you know, I mean, Christina had this sexy sexual reputation, and a lot of it was just Bud mouthing off. And there's several where she stands up to a guy. And I mean, the other thing, and it's sort of the Archie Bunker defense, as I've coined it, is that you're not supposed to be like Al. I mean, it is a satire. And, you know, he did his share of shaming, and he did his share of lusting. He was always, always true to Peggy. And we always made sure we did various episodes where that was absolutely nailed in. And also, as braggadocio as he was still in some ways, and as much a working class hero he was, he would end up at the wrong end of the stick. He would always step in it, you know, at the end. So you really couldn't, as a negative role model, it was hard to boast his victories. Yeah, I mean, you could look at parts of it and say it was misogynistic. I mean, he did lust after women, but there were strong women in his life, and he was so loyal to, you know, to Peggy and to his family, that there was a balance.
Yeah, especially one of my favorite episodes that shows that is definitely the episode where his old girlfriend, played by Vanna White, comes back and wants to basically buy him, and they're going to do it. And then the whole scene where they're saying goodbye, Peggy and Al are, and it's like you can actually see like this emotion, like, oh, you know, and they end up staying together, and it's just,
and they end up staying together, yeah. And then they end up staying, hey, you're a little too close to me, will you move up, you know, yeah. After that, you know. And the other one that's like that is that Al and Peggy have this huge fight, and he leaves very early in the episode, and he goes off to an apartment of his friends, and he could have this affair with this woman who's basically begging him to have this affair with him. And he approaches, he avoids, he approaches, he finally goes home and makes love to Peggy, and the audience goes crazy. So there was never any doubt, script-wise or story-wise, that we wanted the audience to never, ever think that he would be unfaithful to her, or that he would abandon his kids, or any of that. I mean, we made sure that we were plenty grounded in that, and that allowed us a lot of playroom, you know, in other areas. Yeah. As a rite of passage, he took Bud to the nudie bar, which you think, okay, he's taking Bud to the nudie bar and, you know, going to show him these new, and why did he take him there? It turns out because he loved to get into bar fights. He wanted his son to get into his first bar fight. And, you know, I mean, it's absurd and crazy, but that's the way we were.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I did want to talk about, though, because the show struggled for a while in the ratings and everything like that, right? Because, of course, they were on Fox new network, right, all of that. And then what happened was Terry Ricolta comes along and does her own like crusade, moral crusade, especially after seeing the episode Her Cups Runneth Over. And you talked to Terry, and I want to know, because if it wasn't for her, you know, she's part of the reason the show took off in season three. So were you, how did that come about that you talked to her? And were you at all like hesitant about that, or was she, or?
You know, neither of us were. I mean, I tracked her down. She's a very busy woman. She's done a lot of, she actually works, she's an advocate for the arts overseas. She worked for the State Department and stuff like that. And she was very, very happy to talk, and she was very open. And she explained a couple of things to me. One that, you know, that I sort of peripherally knew about, but okay, so she sees this show with her kids and she's horribly offended by it. And she feels, one of her strongest complaints was that it was the time slot. It was on at 8:30 and the family hour starts at 9:00. But that, I mean, so she calls and tries to complain to Fox. Fox at the time was so new, they didn't have a, I don't know what you'd call it, a complaint department. They didn't have a corporate channel for sort of taking those things. So they routed her to the show. And this was a huge mistake, which she understands. They routed her to the show, and she talked on that phone call, she talked to the writer of the episode. So she's trying to get satisfaction out of this big corporate, you know, that she thinks is a big mistake. And she's talking to the person who wrote it. So the person didn't make a lot of apologies about it. And they said, you know, what you need to do if you don't like it is change the channel. So this set Terry just really pissed her off. And then so she went directly to Colgate-Palmolive, to Tam Brands, to Coca-Cola, to General Motors, to all these sponsors. And she got them to say that they were going to pull their sponsorship unless Fox did something about the show. Fox said that they would take a look at it and that they would examine the scripts a little bit more closely. And then they changed the time slot from 8:30 to 9:00. And Terry Ricolta became a media darling. You have to understand, she was on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post. She was on Nightline. She was on the morning talk shows. This one-woman crusade, she really struck a chord. And she got all this attention. And what happens sometimes, and what happened in this instance, was that all the publicity from her crusade got viewers to watch the show. Now, it's one thing to watch the show for 1 week, but those viewers stayed. And the result was all these corporate entities who claimed they wanted to wash their hands of Married with Children said, we want to come back and advertise because the ratings were up. And we got more people to advertise, and the show took off. And she was she didn't regret. I mean, she felt she accomplished something, that she got the time slot changed. And she felt that maybe if it had been handled differently, if the corporation, if Fox had talked to her directly, that she may have softened it, you know, it may have changed things, but, you know, so anyway, I applaud her for being honest and for giving me a long interview. And she got a lot of blowback. People called her horrible things in the press. They put the Detroit Free Press, or one of the newspapers, published her divorce papers. So she got attacked too. I don't feel bad for her. And, you know, and she understands also that she helped launch the show. It was really interesting to talk to her, and she was quite genteel and polite about the whole thing. So,
yeah, I thought it was really interesting to hear from her in there, because that was such, I mean, and it became, you know, integrated into the show too, like little bits about her throughout series.
We referred to her as this woman in Detroit complained, and then even on other shows, The Simpsons did a show where they were trying to censor the Michelangelo's David or something like that. And they found a way to refer back to Terry Ricolta. I mean, her name is in the vernacular as a result of this. But yeah.
And then kind of playing off that a little bit is a lot of some storylines. And, you know, you already talked a little bit about that with making Bud do like the rapper and stuff like that, and that coming from the actor. But there were things that were incorporated. And I know that after Katie sadly lost her baby in season six, with her other pregnancies, you didn't incorporate that into the show. But I was wondering if there was anything, if there was like a favorite of yours of like a real life moment that was incorporated into the show.
Not of mine, but a show that I co-wrote where called You Better Watch Out, where Santa parachutes to his death in the backyard of the Bundy house came from someone who witnessed something like that. He was at a supermarket mall opening and Santa was going to parachute into the parking lot and the parachute didn't open and it fell down. So that was one that one in particular was from a real life incident that I enjoyed. I'm trying to think of any other ones. We certainly didn't go through headlines. You know, I mean, people were having fights with their spouses or, you know, whatever, then, you know, those got incorporated and they got blown up. But, you know, pretty much, you know, the writers come in the room and everyone starts talking about, you know, what's going on. And all of a sudden a story develops, you know, and it might be a fight that you had with your family or, you know, I think maybe from a real life incident where Al doesn't pay the telephone bill. You know, where you get charged for a call you didn't make and you try to complain and get it off your bill. And his complaint turned out to just destroy the whole family because the phone company pulled their telephone usage. And, you know, that's a nice extension of a real life story.
And then I think, you know, what might surprise people for some reason, I think it might actually surprise people about how much diversity there was behind the scenes. Behind the camera, because I think it's one thing to have diversity in front of the camera, but behind the camera, I think is just as important. How do you think that shaped like some of the storylines or the environment there?
There were a lot of women who were writers on the show. There was the woman who directed the pilot, and for most of the first two couple seasons was a woman. There were several women on the staff. They're African American writers. I think that Ron and there was never, well, first of all, Ron and Michael are diverse. Michael's African-American, Black. Ron is Jewish. There never, ever was a sense of quotas or hiring for diversity. Everybody was hired for their talent. And there was African-American writers. There were Asian writers. There was white writers. There was no consciousness of it. And you know, it contributes because you just talk about your life. You talk about your culture. You talk about your family, you know, when you're talking about stories and women and their experience and, you know, also diversity of, you know, there were Harvard students and there were people who didn't go to college, you know, the diversity on all kinds of levels. So there were people who came to writing from all kinds of, you know, from sales, you know, and so all of that goes into the stew. Of, you know, because the story, particularly in Married with Children, the creation of the stories, yeah, it started with Ron and Michael sitting up at the front desk, and everybody else is sitting around. But then everyone else just pitches in, and bits and pieces of this stew, you know, turn into a story. And gay stories, straight stories. We had a trans character who was a football star, so. You know, it's the openness started at the top and not an ounce of self-consciousness about it. It was all just hiring people that they thought were funny or that they wanted to be around. And that was the work pattern. That was how we worked.
And I want to ask, at the end of every chapter in here, you have something, you have a postscript and you'll like share like little antidotes or little ongoing gags or running themes. Yeah. Right. Is there a favorite? Do you have a favorite like running theme through the show?
I like when Marcy, this yuppie, you know, career oriented person, all of a sudden gets triggered and she remembers a date that she had in high school or a situation where the girls shunned her or something like that. And she'll just go into a speed rap and she'll just go on and on and on. And then all of a sudden she'll compose herself. And she just did that brilliantly, both the starting it and the finishing of it. That was really one of my favorites. Her having on-screen orgasms was pretty fun.
Yeah.
And it's actually sort of an extension of that, because she just lets her character just go. And then all of a sudden she sort of becomes self-aware and pulls it back. And I think she was just brilliant at that. I think that's definitely my favorite of those ongoing things. I like the sports things. I like the sports things. I can relate. You know, I was a tennis player in high school, and I was on the tennis team, and I was really pretty good. And nothing later in life sort of compares to sometimes those moments on the team and your glory. And Al and his buddies, they all try to replicate that in one way or another. And it's usually kind of pathetic, but it's brilliant in its conception. Like Al pretending to be older so he can win the senior Olympic, you know, or the guys putting the team back together so they can replay the championship game. And those are really relatable things. And they're crazily executed. And then you're just brought back to reality. And I think people love that about Al, that he, you know, he scored 4 touchdowns in 1 game. I mean, that's one of the things that you're talking about. And that nothing in his life has really ever lived up to that. And yet he tries to find that 4 touchdowns in a game in something else, in something that happens at work, in something, you know, in bringing in a new toilet, in remodeling his bathroom, or in whatever I just love that about him. And I do think that the sports stories were great. Yeah. I mean, they're male centric mostly, but they really brought out the strengths and the foibles of all of our characters. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would even think, I don't know if you would agree, but even the No Ma'am, when No Ma'am came along, that was even like kind of like not a sport to say, but it kind of gave that team camaraderie to Al that he wanted.
Yeah. 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 And then he found with those guys, you know, they could tell their story, and they were just stupid stories, and they were just, you know, they made stupid proclamations, and they had them go out, you know, to be initiated. They did just these crazy things, and it just gave them something that I remember that I had, you know, a goofy time in high school and college like that. And Ed told me it reminded him of Cub Scout meetings that he had when he was a kid, where they would just sit around and essentially accomplish nothing, you know, and they were supposed to be getting these badges or whatever it was. And, you know, he loved that group. The Michael Moy tried to get the Fox to do No Ma'am as a spinoff, and they didn't go for it.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Yeah. That would have been interesting.
And then when they went on the Jerry Springer show.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pathetic, but it was just funny. I mean, because the spirit behind it is so strong. It's so misguided. You know, nothing good is going to come of this, but you can't wait to see, you know, what happens. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that was true of a lot of the characters on the show, is there would be like, a lot of times you'd be like, that's so misguided the way you're doing that. But there was such this goal, like happiness and passion and finding something to do. Like even in like one of my absolute all-time favorite moments in the whole show is when Al sells his blood for when Kelly is hustling pool, and he sells the blood to get the money, and he comes there and he's got like, you know, he's like, well, the brain hides some blood, and just the way Ed O'Neill delivers those lines is so amazing. And even that was even a moment of like belief in his daughter, but also wanting to win, and then, yeah, not ending up winning, but still that fight.
His fights, I mean, the fights that he takes, you know, it's like when he got, okay, so there's a burglar who comes into his house, and Al smacks the burglar to defend his household, and he ends up getting sued for hitting the burglar. So he goes to court, and he represents himself, of course. And he just is not apologetic in the least. And then he loses the case. He loses $5,000 or whatever. And he says, you know, I don't have $5,000 anyway. So what the hell? Make it 10. And he hits the guy. And, you know, you're on his side and you know it's going to go down in defeat. But, you know, you root for the guy anyway.
Yeah. And I want to know, I know this may be impossible to answer, and I don't know if you even want to, but since the show did not get the finale that people would have wanted, and because the network canceled, didn't give them time to give that, and, you know, the stars even found out, like, without even from, not even from the network, is there, like, anything you would have loved to have seen that we didn't get to see, like, any moment or anything? I know that's a hard question to answer, but...
You think of the finales, you know, think of the Seinfeld finale that didn't turn out so well. It's hard to wrap it up completely. And the one thing I said in the book that was odd, in the 11th season, there were a couple of episodes that had a finale-esque kind of moment. And the moment that I thought kind of wrapped up the series was when Christina was going to marry this rich guy, and they found out that the guy had been cheating on him. And this marriage would have, you know, change Al's life, you know, because it was a wealthy family and so on and so forth. And Christina stood up for herself, and Al stood up for her. And she said, you know, it's, I'm not sure the exact quote, it's in the book, but of, you know, for once, you know, it's like, I'm really proud to be a Bundy. And to me, you know, I guess if that were really a finale, you would have built more up to that moment and hinged more on it. But, you know, I felt that idea that you're proud, that someone was proud to be a Bundy, even as humiliating as, you know, as it always is to be a Bundy, to watch Al be a buffoon and so on and so forth. And in that moment, I mean, that to me was a series ending kind of moment that didn't get, it wasn't held up and as one. So it didn't have kind of the spotlight of it, but. That's just my take.
Yeah, because it is hard, because you do want to have that. It's so hard. Endings are really hard to do, I think, successfully. But it's really hard when you're not given that chance to really do it. Yeah. But I'm glad that they at least had some episodes in that last season that did give a little bit of that finality. Yeah. And I want to know, because I love asking people this. What did you learn about yourself as a writer, as a creator, as an artist through writing this book?
Through writing the book? It was very difficult because, you know, in writing Married with Children, you go off and you write your individual episodes, but the rest of it is a group process. And even when you're finished, before you write the episode, the group writes with you, then you go off and write, and then you come back. And then you rewrite together. In this instance, I was sitting here, literally here where I am now, in front of my computer, literally with this computer. And I would just have moments where I'm just looking around. I was like, where is everybody? You know, I think I learned that, you know, that if you don't, I think a lot of things came to me when I wasn't forcing myself to write. A lot of things came to me when I wasn't thinking about it, when I was just sort of pacing and walking around. And, you know, I think a lot of the things I learned, I actually believe that even though I'm sitting down and I'm writing this book and it's so different than writing something for the stage, a lot of the things that I learned on Married with Children about beginnings, middles, and ends and paying things off and having things sort of evolve organically, a lot of those things actually applied to the book. And so a lot of things that I learned from Michael and Ron and from my training actually did apply, and trying to pace and to try and, you know, just sort of peaks and valleys, and, you know, so a lot of things said did apply. And I learned that it takes a lot longer to write and try to book than to write a TV episode. And, you know, I had my deadlines, but they were like, it was like a year and a half as opposed to a week. But yeah, I ended up really enjoying the process. And part of it was, you know, it was just an enjoyable experience. I mean, I could go back It wasn't like I was going back and reliving, you know, childhood of poverty and misery or something. I was going back and reliving. And the other thing was, you know, I called all these people, you know, a camera person, the wardrobe person, the actors, and they, you know, I was able their joy just poured out. And so I was able to sort of channel their joy into it. So they became characters almost like the Married with Children characters, you know, and almost everyone that I talked to said that it was kind of the peak experience of their professional career working on that show. And that was just, that was a joy. It was fun.
Yeah, that definitely came across. It was great hearing from cast and crew and other people involved, because I think that also gives you a sense that, oh, okay, I'm glad that they enjoyed this as much as I enjoyed watching it. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me. And I just, on a personal note, I just wanted to say my father passed away in January, and my dad loved Married with Children. Uh-huh. Like, this was his absolute favorite show. Al was his hero. He had a huge, huge crush on Katie Sagal. And so reading this book was just such a great treat in that way of having memories of my dad. So I just wanted to thank you for being a part of creating this show that brought so much joy.
And thank you. And your questioning, you were so tuned in. And I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So
I mean, tuned into the material, and I don't mean just tuned into me being here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And once again, everybody go pick up the book. So, and it's available. This will be out the week that it's available on the 23rd everywhere. Right. So yeah.
You can pre-order now if you want.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Take care.
Thank you again to Richard for sitting down and talking with me. And once again, if you are a Married with Children fan, you really should pick up this book. It's just absolutely fantastic, filled with so many amazing behind-the-scenes stories, and it'll make you appreciate the show more. So highly, highly recommend it. Be sure to like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/itsafandomthingpod. On Twitter at Fandom Thing Pod. No, it's in that one. On Instagram at It's a Fandom Thing Pod. On TikTok and Threads at It's a Fandom Thing Pod. If you'd like to be a potential interview guest on the show, please feel free to reach out to us via our website, itsafandomthingpod.com. Click the Contact Us button there, and that'll shoot me an email, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Until next time, remember, it's a fandom thing. Black Lives Matter, and stop Asian hate.